Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Now, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Shkwembekulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today our guest on Food Conversations has a unique story to tell. It's a story about food, and local food in particular, but it's also a story about a bold and creative approach to daily life. Suzanne Crocker is a former family physician who is now a full-time filmmaker. She lives with her three children and her husband, also a former family physician, near Dawson City in the Yukon. Several years ago, Suzanne and her family lived for an entire year on local food produced in and around their home near that northern community. Now, listeners need to understand that Dawson City is located on the 64th parallel, with summer temperatures as high as 30 degrees Celsius, and temperatures during the long winter months often down to minus 40 degrees. Suzanne made a film of the experience called First We Eat, which in 2020 won a $10,000 Canadian Feature Audience Award at the Hot Docs Festival in Toronto, the largest documentary film festival in North America. Suzanne, we are absolutely delighted to have you join us on Food Conversations. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here from Dawson City on the traditional and contemporary territory of the Toronto Kuchin.
The Toronto Kuchin we will talk about in a moment. An important thing that we're starting to understand that our Indigenous friends and neighbors have so much more to contribute to us than we ever realized before because we were too snooty and now we're sort of waking up. Now, since you made First We Eat, you still eat most of your food. You said about 90% from local sources. So I thought I'd start off by asking you what you had in your last meal that you could consider, at 90% locally produced. What was in that meal?
Well, I'd say the last real meal would have been supper yesterday. And we had a pork belly from a locally raised pig, and roast potatoes that were locally grown and stored all winter in a root cellar, so they were still perfect, and a glass of milk from our local dairy cows.
We're going to be talking about food production in Dawson City because it's an extraordinary story in some ways, and what you did when you spent this year was really outlined how extraordinary it is. Now, the genesis of the film, why local food? What was it that made this seem like a really good idea?
It was a combination of things. I have always been interested in the concept of self-sufficiency and in my adult life in the concept of sustainability. And living here in Dawson City, where 97% of our food is trucked in from the south, which is thousands and thousands of kilometers away, you don't actually think about that too much. You assume the grocery store is this limitless supply of food until the only road into Dawson gets closed, maybe by a wildfire or a landslide or something. All of a sudden, you realize that you start to realize some of the implications that the grocery store is actually dependent on that food chain.
Absolutely.
And I also came to understand, you know, that of course the Toronto Kuchin lived on local food here back before colonization for thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of years. And apparently around 100 years ago, in the early 1900s, Dawson City used to produce 97% of its own food. So we've sort of switched from producing 97% of our own food to importing 97% of our food.
Dawson City was actually, and the Yukon in general, was actually a source of produce, especially vegetables, for the southern part of the country. Grew with this extra long growing season in the summer, would have two crops. I've seen pictures of cabbages that were like a foot and a half across because you can grow them when you have this really long growing season. And then we went nuts. We went to the exact opposite. Now it's the other way around. 97% is from elsewhere. So that was a pretty good motivation of survival, but also correcting and increasing sustainability. There were advantages and disadvantages. There were struggles and, you know, obstacles and advantages. What was the biggest advantage that you saw of doing this? What was it really doing that spoke to you?
Well, I wanted to know if it could still be done. Hmm. And if it could be done in this era with a family where we're not a nomadic people following the food source. So that was, you know, my goal is not to just talk about food sovereignty and the importance of local food, but to actually test it out
and
do it and see what I would discover. Is it possible? What the choke points would be?
What was the hardest food all that year? What was the hardest food or food ingredient to get? Lots of things turned out to be fairly easy to get, but what was the hardest thing?
I think one of the challenges, surprisingly, was oil and vinegar, especially oil. My fats, there was no problem with fats because there's animal fat, there's leaf lard from the pig, there's butter you can make from the cream from the dairy cows. But I began to realize, you know, just how often we use liquid oil in things. So that was a surprise to me. The inability of having granulated sugar also proved to be an issue for anything that came to baking. So I had liquid sugar through birch syrup and honey, but no solid sugar. Although I did try and make sugar from sugar beets.
What about salt? In the film, salt's a bit of an issue.
Salt is an interesting aspect of the film. And I knew going into this project that salt would be missed from a flavor point of view. And it was at first. Everything tasted really bland. But what was interesting is after about 6 weeks with no salt, it was like my taste buds suddenly came alive and I could really taste the flavors in food. And I would find things like spinach tasting salty and tomatoes tasting salty. And I didn't miss salt from a flavor point of view anymore.
Interesting.
I knew physiologically that because I was eating meat and fish, I didn't need added salt. I would get enough from meat and fish. And I did test my blood throughout the experiment and found that would be the case because I knew people would ask me that.
So you weren't sodium deficient?
No, I wasn't sodium deficient. Mm-hmm. And really, when it came down to it, I realized that the importance of salt is food preservation. So for making things like bacon and sausage, for cheese making, brining cheese, you know, for preserving food if you don't have 8 months of winter like we do. So it sort of became a challenge to me to think about, because we're not anywhere near the ocean, if we had any other sources of salt here other than, you know, what used to happen, which would be people would have traded for salt from communities by the ocean, which in the end would make the most sense. But I did try some bizarre alternatives.
Eventually found a salt lick. Somebody turned you on to a salt lick that the other species in the area had identified, and you were able to get some actual salt from there. I remember in the film, this sort of brownish, sort of unusual-looking material, and then watching as somebody tasted it and said, oh, that really is quite salty. That is all right. Now, you raise another issue, which is storage. The food availability in the dark depths of winter is much different from what it is in the growing season. You must have had a significant storage capacity or developed it. What was that like?
Storage was a really big issue. And, I learned why stores are called stores, because basically storing food for us. We had five chest freezers plus maybe 10 Rubbermaid tubs on the veranda during the 8 months where our outdoors is a freezer, plus borrowing somebody else's chest freezer, plus borrowing a portion of somebody's walk-in freezer, plus a lot of canned goods, plus onions under the bed, plus all the root vegetables being in the farmer's root cellar, which is the size of a sea can.
I have visions here. I have visions of you kind of wending your way through the storage media that had been established in your home.
Yeah, there was food, the evidence of food in almost every room of the house, I think, maybe except the bathroom.
Did that have anything to do with the title? I mean, First We Eat is a fairly evocative title. And when you're surrounded by the food resources that you need to make it through the whole year, talk about the title a little bit and how you came upon it.
So the title is from a quote from M.H.K. Fisher, "First we eat, then we do everything else." And the idea of that quote is that eating, like breathing, is fundamental to our survival. And so eating needs to be considered a basic need, and therefore the importance of food and where it comes from and how it's produced and its nutritional value and what we're putting in our body is sort of essential before we think of being able to do anything else.
I'm going to remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Susan Crocker, who's a full-time filmmaker in Dawson City, Yukon. Now, it wasn't just food, it was also people. There are three children and one husband who had to be part of this team. It's very hard to sort of be a solo food all year locally person. You have to have it with your family. So what was that like, that process of bringing on board? Well, if you had to bring them on board, if they nudge you, says, "Yes, Mom, we want to do this." In the film, it's clear there was a little bit of ambivalence, especially with your kids. But what was that like, that process?
That was a challenge. I would say you're being very kind, saying there was a little bit of ambivalence. They all flatly refused to be part of this project.
Yes, I remember the no. The word no came up.
Yeah. And it wasn't really until I convinced my husband to join me. And I think I'm still really unsure why he caved and agreed to. I feel like it was purely the challenge and the intrigue of it that got him on board. But once he was on board, then the kids followed suit, because of course we are the people who brought the groceries into the house. They weren't about to be walking 2 kilometers to the grocery store and bringing home the groceries in their backpack. So that they sort of had to join at that point. But they were, you know, the rule was no grocery store food or non-locally produced food in the house. But outside the house, they were three teenagers. They could do whatever they wanted.
Free for all, roughly speaking. But you noted to me when we were talking before that your kids still eat about 75% of their food locally grown. So it did have an impact. It did change their perspective about food.
Yes, it did for sure. And you know, I would say they eat 75% local food when they're at home. They're now all off at university, actually. So they're doing whatever, eating in cafeteria food. But
they're eating local food, but it's not local food anymore.
Yeah, that's right. But they did really gain an appreciation for where their food comes from. I know, for example, Kate, my daughter at university, says it's really difficult for her to buy meat at the grocery store because she doesn't know how it was raised or where it came from. And so they are definitely very conscious about that. And after the year of eating local, the pandemic came along, and they lost their usual summer jobs. And so they ended up all volunteering and then working for local farmers, which then gave them an even greater sense of where their food comes from and what's involved in getting it on their plate. So they definitely aren't the kind of kids who think that chicken comes as a chicken breast wrapped in cellophane on a store shelf.
On a styrofoam tray. You also found out a lot about your neighbors and your friends, that many of them were living double lives. They were having a day job, and then secretly they were doing unusual things related to food. Why don't you talk about them? A couple of names that I recall were Grant, John, and Megan. But let's talk about the people that you became intimately involved with in this experiment, if you want to call it. Who is Grant, and what did he do in his dual life?
Well, Grant probably isn't a great example of a double life person, because Grant I knew as a farmer. He grew up in Toronto, and in his 20s, he moved to the Yukon, to Dawson, wanted to live more sustainably and self-sufficiently on the land, was a trapper for a while, and eventually purchased or leased an island on the Yukon River upstream from Dawson that he cleared and got an agricultural lease for to start farming on. And he actually produced, like, that land was one of the most prolific growing places in the Yukon because it's a micro ecosystem being on the river. So he produced a lot of food, both for the grocery stores, the restaurants, and the local farmers market. He used to boat downriver with his crates of food several times a week. So yeah, it was an incredible farmer. But there were some other folks that I didn't realize were producing food. For example, Diana, I knew her because she worked in the local liquor store. And I had no idea that where she lived, which was downriver quite a ways, she had this humongous berry farm producing Saskatoons and Hascaps and black currants. And Peter was another example of a surprise. Peter I knew because he was the manager of a auto parts store. And he also lived downriver, but I had no idea he was raising sheep. So a lot of our growers here live on the far sides of rivers. And so you don't see what they're doing as far as growers. You just see them in town.
And it's a function of an ecosystem that is not a grid of roadways, an ecosystem that is formed of landforms and ecological features of one sort or another. It's not automatic that you say, oh, yes, I saw them next door growing something. They're up river, as you say.
Yeah, Dawson is a tiny, like, Dawson itself is a tiny bit of land that used to be a moose swamp at the confluence of two rivers, surrounded by hills. So there isn't any, other than backyards, there isn't any large growing space in Dawson itself. So all the farming area is up or down one of the two rivers.
Hidden away. The other thing is the rivers themselves are modes of transport, as they have always been in human history. They've always been a way to get quickly and easily from one place to another. And there's a lot of footage in the film of people in boats going upstream slowly and downstream quickly. It's obviously, that's a highway. That's a highway that you have often the hinterland, as we would call it, an important one too.
Yeah, the river is very important, has been very important for the Toronto Kwich'in throughout millennia, is important now, and also in the winter time is crossed usually by ice roads or ice bridges. But with climate change, that we're seeing that it's getting harder and harder, and some years it's really difficult to get an ice road or an ice bridge. So that's some very poignant climate change impact that we're seeing in this area.
That's something that a colleague of mine, Courtney Howard, who works in Yellowknife, has noted, that especially her Indigenous friends and neighbors who always used to be able to cross rivers as an easy way to go from A to B. Some of them have fallen into the river because the ice is no longer as solid as it used to be. Let's talk a little bit about the Trongit-Wichin, an important element in the community. As I understand, they have up to 1,100 or so members of their community. They play a role in the film as well, but they're a unique indigenous nation because they were early on through the land claim process and became independent and self-sufficient. Why don't you talk about their role in the film and what they were teaching you as well?
Yes, the Trongit-Wichin are one of the first self-governing First Nations in Canada, which is amazing. They have a long history, the Trongit-Wichin, of generosity, including when the first settlers came to this area, helping them survive the winter, helping them learn how to hunt, providing them with meat. And that spirit of generosity continues to this day, despite all the horrible things that they, as other First Nations, have been put through by our colonialism through the Indian Act and residential school.
Let's talk about that word generosity, because in settler culture, there's a lot of individualism and competition. But that's because we aren't dealing with the exigencies of the ecosystem. It's not telling us we got to behave or we're going to be in trouble. Just want to mention to listeners that there was a lovely looking tabby cat who arose on the table a moment ago from the scene from our home to your home. But that generosity, it seems to me, is connected intimately to the fact that the ecosystem plays such a profound role in the life of Indigenous peoples and is not something they know. It's not something they can control. And neither can we, but we have this illusion that we can, to the point now where we're actually ruining the ecosystem with our careless behavior. What about that whole issue of generosity as a kind of life skill?
Yeah, I think it's really important. And I think it came very apparent during this year of Eating Local that it wasn't just going to be a personal project, that I myself was not going to be able to feed my family for a year, but it was going to be a community project. And it takes a community to feed a family and a community to feed a community. So that became very apparent to me. And the Trongit-Wichin, as part of regenerating a lot of traditional knowledge, that connection from grandparent to parent to child of that knowledge was severed in many cases because of residential school. They in rejuvenating that, hold many what they call culture camps throughout the year. So there's first fish, there's first hunt for caribou, there's fall harvest camp for moose and harvesting off the land, there's hide tanning camps. And they, Trongit-Wichin, generously invited me to be a participant in those culture camps, which are aimed at teaching youth, all youth, not just Trongit-Wichin youth, but all youth in our community, these skills. And that was a really amazing experience for me. And there was a lot of knowledge shared. I remember going out to look for wild rhubarb with Trongit-Wichin elder Victor Henry, because I'd heard about wild rhubarb, but I didn't know what it looked like. So Victor and I went out for an afternoon. He knew where there was some. We harvested a whole basket full, and I thought, okay, great, I now understand wild rhubarb. I came back home, and there in my own yard had been growing wild rhubarb all that time. But it took Victor to open my eyes to be able to see it.
It's such a story. It's such a story for all of us. That we only, there's an expression we have, I wouldn't have believed if I hadn't seen it. But the actual truth, psychologically speaking, is I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. In other words, when your eyes are open and your mind is opened, then you see the things that you walked by daily oblivious to because it just didn't seem relevant to your life. What role did you see Indigenous participants in the film and your friends and neighbors who are Indigenous play in helping you understand about sustainability? Because you said earlier, they've had to keep a sustainable world around them, or they did because Mother Nature was telling them what to do most of the time. How did that influence your own thinking as you saw that happening, as well as the settlers and others who were growing food? How did that affect your mind?
Well, I think Indigenous culture is very aware of the idea of our symbiotic relationship in the natural world, that we are just one part of that symbiosis, that it's not a pyramid where we're on top and nature's on the bottom. And I mean, that's a lesson that we all, a really important lesson that we all can learn from, and is a really important lesson for the sustainability of our planet, I believe, and our role in it. So that was a very important lesson. There was also, again, this idea of foraging food from the land, foods that I used to not notice or considered weeds, understanding that they were actually food sources and the value in that. There was the concept of generosity and sharing, where somebody gets a moose, it doesn't go into that person's freezer, but is shared. At first fish, when a king salmon, which the king salmon are not actually being fished for much, well, not at all commercially, and only very rarely by the Tronda Kwichin because of the very low populations due to overfishing in the oceans and climate change. But during first fish, at that time, they were allowed to catch a few king salmon. And the first king salmon that was caught, they gifted the salmon eggs to us, which was a real honor in recognition of the experiment we were trying to do of living locally.
We have so much to learn from our Indigenous friends and neighbors, and we're starting to learn it finally. The scales have dropped off our eyes, and the culture of Indigenous peoples holds secrets that are now coming out and are telling us what we need to do to change our ways to protect our overall own survival on this blue-green planet of ours. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Suzanne Crocker, who's a full-time filmmaker and former family physician living in Dawson City in the Yukon. Now, First We Eat was your second major documentary film. The first one was called All the Time in the World, and it was about living off-grid for not a full year, but most of a year. What was the motivation behind that film, which came before First We Eat?
The motivation for All the Time in the World didn't have anything to do with the film, actually. We were two busy parents with three young kids who were growing up too fast from our perspective. And
they have a bad habit of doing that, don't they?
They do. And we just found that as they were growing up before our eyes, we were spending a lot of time distracted by other projects, committees, work, sucked into the computer. And so we wanted to reconnect as a family. And to do so, we thought, as the parents, we're going to have to do full abstinence from technology, from work, from all these other external forces. So we decided to go on the land, which is not an unfamiliar concept here, going on the land.
So who was that hardest for, you as adults or your kids, who are in Western culture notoriously attached to their devices?
It definitely wasn't hard for our kids. They loved it. They were 10, 8, and 4 at the time. The idea of spending all that time outdoors with their family, was just incredible. For 9 months, they didn't once say, I miss home, I miss my friends. Sibling rivalry was at its least. So I suppose it was probably harder for my husband and I, but we were quite motivated to do it. So actually, you know, it didn't feel like a chore. It was an amazing experience and one of the best years of our life as a family.
That's so interesting, because there's this perception that children and young people have to have their devices or they can't function. But in actual fact, it was the other way around. They were able to leave it behind and adapt more readily than you were. What an interesting experience.
Yes, I think children are incredibly adaptable, but also boredom isn't necessarily a bad thing. Boredom allows for creativity and imagination to flourish. So our kids were creating their own board games, were doing oral storytelling, were turning the forests into fairylands. It was pretty incredible.
Out of the mouths of babes, you know, the children shall lead us. It's such a powerful thing that we really don't spend enough time paying attention to it. And of course, when you're out in a natural setting, you're the humans. It's not like there's 10,000 humans surrounding you on all sides. Now, Dawson City has been your home for decades now, but you actually began your life on the other side of this large continent of ours, in Parry Sound, which is on the eastern shore of Georgian Bay, which is a huge extension of Lake Huron. I had about 6,500 people in it at the present time. But I was very interested, when I was looking up a little background on Parry Sound, that the community that was built by the settlers was right next to an Ojibwa community called Waksuksing. Now, I'm not sure if you probably knew this, but the name means place that shines brightly in the reflection of the sacred light. Now, I think everybody on planet Earth would love to live in a place that had a title like that. But back then, this was before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This was before stories of the residential school system were current. They were being buried and hidden and deliberately obfuscated. Were you aware of the indigenous people there in Parry Sound? What kind of place did they have in the community?
When I was a elementary age child, there were other kids in my class from what was then referred to as Parry Island, as opposed to its Ojibwe name, and First Nation kids. And they, to me, were just other kids. You know, I guess I knew they were from what we called Parry Island then, Waksuksing. But I didn't sort of have us or them sensation about anything. When I went to high school, most of them kind of disappeared from the scene. And I don't know that I really thought about that much, but I will tell you, as an adult, I've thought about that a lot. I remember reading Joseph Boyden's 3-Day Road,
yes,
if I have
indeed
the title correct, about the war hero who was a Pegamagabo from Waksuksing. He was a really important sniper in the war. And I read that story. I really enjoyed the story. And at the end, in the epilogue section, they said that this person in the fictional story was based on this fellow whose last name was Pegmagabo from Waksuksing. And I was shocked that I had gone through up to grade 13 in history classes in Parry Sound. Never once was this person ever mentioned. There now is actually a statue of him in Parry Sound, which is great. But, you know, I lived my whole life where the community didn't recognize this war hero's efforts, and I had no knowledge of them, of him. And I just thought, wow, it was so divided then. Other than as a young kid, when the concept of, you know, skin color or race or whatever didn't have any bearing on how we saw the world. So it was just such a very different kind of situation compared to Dawson, and living amongst Toronto Kwich'in citizens, where the culture is so part of our daily life, and we're so part, you know, we're welcomed into it.
That invisibility factor that you made reference to is something that was absolutely central to the invasion of the land that occurred from settlers. We renamed everything according to our own, not even according to the landforms, we named them after our people, you know, Sir something or other Parry in Parry Sound. And that kind of notion of displacing and then becoming completely unaware of the powerful elements of culture that we had displaced because we just thought that we were superior. We thought that we were the people who belonged here, when of course we were interlopers and our understanding was quite limited. You quoted in your remarks when you sent them to me from a book called The Overstory, a quote about superior beings. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit? Because that's relevant to what we're talking about now.
Yes, thank you. So Richard Powers refers to the natural world as the more than human world. And that's how he talks about it in his when he's interviewed. And I just think that's an amazing expression because it reverses this idea of the human species being in control of the natural world. And actually, as we know, we wouldn't exist without the natural world. And so the more than human world is the reason why we have oxygen to breathe and why we have food to eat and why we can exist on this planet. So I think that using that term, the more than human world, is really poignant.
When you were in school, one of the things that happened was you went out canoeing and backpacking quite a bit with the Out Trip Club, which I love the name. You have to say it in three very separate words. Your father was a pharmacist, your mother was a school teacher, and your mother was somebody who really showed you a path. She exhibited in her daily life a path of trying new things, and you described a few things to me that illustrated that, you know, things to do with Chinese and things to do with all sorts of unusual things. But she was a school teacher, but as she was becoming ill, unfortunately, with breast cancer, she at that time went off to Osgoode Hall to start studying law. Her law career was never fully achieved because she became very ill and she died. And there's two things that strike me about that. One is that you saw this woman as a model who said, let's step outside the boundaries of where we are now and try something new and different. But also because she died at this critical point of your life, you were in your late teens, around 1920. What was it like having this really important model taken away from you and because of sickness, because of disease? Because you were up to that point, you'd been studying engineering as a pragmatic sort of thing. You weren't all that happy with it. Then you went off to Laval and studied some courses in French. But at that point, you at the time your mother was coming to the end of her life, you moved into life sciences and medicine. Now, there's serendipity everywhere. That was a powerful experience. It's always a powerful experience when a parent dies when you're young. What was that like for you in terms of shaping where you went from there on?
My mother as a role model was important in several ways in shaping my journey. One was, as you described, she was always up for a new challenge. And I feel that I have inherited that from her, that I like to challenge myself.
I would say in spades. I would have to say in spades.
But also, you know, I had been studying engineering partly because I really enjoyed deductive reasoning and figuring out how things worked. But I think throughout my mother's illness and my exposure to hospitals and doctors and the concept of illness, I began to understand that I was more interested in how people worked than how things worked. And that therefore led me to the path of medicine, which then ended up being a filmmaker, which doesn't necessarily follow. But.
Well, you never know. Just to remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Suzanne Crocker, who is a filmmaker and former family physician in Dawson City in the Yukon. Well, what it, in practical terms that led to was you not only embracing medicine as a career, which you hadn't really thought about, as you told me before then, but also it's how you combined that with other interests that you had already, the interest in getting out in the natural world, for example. So your residency wasn't in a large urban center. You went to Memorial University and you were able there to experience medicine in remote and rural settings. So it's almost like you were preparing yourself for the next step without even knowing what the next step was. But what triggered you, you said, to the next step was a slideshow on the Yukon. Now, tell the world about that slideshow and what it did to you, Suzanne.
So after I finished my residency, I worked locumed a bit in Southern Ontario, but I really wanted to go to a Northern community. So I just was thinking about, would I go to Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories? Would I go to Whitehorse in the Yukon to locum for a summer? And just by serendipity, I had been home in Parry Sound visiting my father, who was invited to a friend's house where their adult children had come home from the Yukon and were showing a slideshow of the Yukon. And it only took a few slides.
It was that quick. It was that quick. It was just, it spoke to you so clearly.
The beauty of the Yukon. Now, of course, maybe if I'd gone to a slideshow from the Northwest Territories, I would have seen the beauty of the Northwest Territories. But what I saw was the beauty of the Yukon, the mountains, the rivers, the forests. And that just clinched it. Okay, I'm going to the Yukon.
You said, I knew I'd found my people. That's the phrase you used to me. And of course, that's because people live in the Yukon as well. I worked for a mining engineer for a number of summers, and it was mostly in the Yukon. And it is an extraordinary glaciated valleys and hills, really, and rivers. It really is quite astonishing. And many people who have not been north don't realize what a gigantic country we have and how many different ecosystems and terrains and landforms we actually have. So you got there, you went from Whitehorse, did the locum, and went to Dawson City. What was the difference between Whitehorse and Dawson City that made Dawson City seem like the better place?
Well, Whitehorse felt too big. I believe at the time it was probably 25 or 30,000 people, which, depending where you live, you could consider big or small. But to me, it felt too big. Dawson was about 1,500 people. That felt very right. Dawson is this community, as I say, nestled at the confluence of two rivers, surrounded by wilderness. So that really fit for me. And it's just a really unique community. There's an eclectic mix of people who decide to make it their home. Some people who have been born here, some folks who are trying to Kwichin and their families have been here for generations, and many people who just stumble upon this place and never leave because they find that they fit here. It's a very independent crowd. People who've, you know, been from all walks of life, traveled all over the world. It has an amazing cultural aspect for its size. I mean, I learned how to become a documentary filmmaker in this tiny remote town. That's pretty remarkable.
It has the Klondike Institute of Art and Culture. That's not what people think about as the Klondike. What people think about, of course, is the Klondike Gold Rush. And Dawson City was a center for the Gold Rush. The settler community came flooding in, which caused the Klondike Witchin to actually vacate and move a little bit upstream to get away from this noisy, obstreperous crowd of people who were just after some stuff in the ground that they wanted to dig up. The filmmaking part, though, wasn't entirely new to you. Apparently, you were a filmmaker when you were a child. You actually produced a few. They're not in the national repertoire, but you produced a few family films. What was it like doing films in your family circle? How did that go down with the family? Don't take a picture of me when I'm not dressed properly or something.
Oh, it was quite fun, and I didn't really film my family so much as I used the Super 8 camera to do films for school projects. Or I had one of my best friends, Barb, when I was growing up. I made a film called The Day in the Life of Barb, where I played Barb. It was for her birthday, and basically put myself in all her favorite situations and filmed it on the Super 8. And that was, you know, that was interesting because that was the time of actual film where you had to slice it, cut it, tape it together.
I took a film course and I remember doing the tape. The tape was a little skinnier than the film, so it didn't overlap over the edge. What a deal. You said to me at one point, you really like editing film. And I can think it's probably got something to do with the fact you can do it digitally and it's very fast and it's very easy and you can play around with it a lot. It's a lot easier than what you did back then.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I editing, especially in documentary, that is sort of like the sculpting of the clay. In scripted film, you do a lot of work beforehand, you know exactly how it's all going to lay out, and then you shoot and put it together. But in documentary, you don't know what's going to play out. So you're filming a lot of material, and then it's in the edit, and that's your lump of clay. And then in the editing process is when you're sculpting it into a story, and there's a magic about that.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of magic, it was your kids who started to nudge you unexpectedly, but maybe expectedly, back into the world of film. Your oldest child, what happened there?
So when my oldest Sam was 5, he asked me on the way home from school one day to explain the difference between live action and cartoon and how it was made. So I described animation being like a series of pictures, like a flip book. So he immediately came home as a 5-year-old and started drawing a whole bunch of pictures on separate pieces of paper, which we filmed one at a time while he told the story. That short film ended up opening up the Dawson City International Film Festival that year. He was a star.
He must have been proud as punch.
He was very excited by it all. And he went on to work doing stop motion animations. And then my other kids got into stop motion. And in helping them figure out stop motion, I got bit by the bug. I started doing stop motion. And that sort of just started this whole new love for me of storytelling through film.
And storytelling is an important part of your films, the narrative, the tale. That's a central feature. What is it about narrative? I mean, family physicians, of course, deal with narrative in the way we work, if we're doing it properly, which we don't always do these days. But nevertheless, that's the goal, is finding a person's story. What is it about stories and telling stories about people that are so captivating?
I think that we learn from story naturally, that we get engaged with story. I wish I could remember the other Richard Powers quote, but he has another quote about you can make all the arguments in the world, but it's not as effective as a well-told story. So storytelling obviously comes in different forms: oral storytelling, written storytelling, visual storytelling through film. But story has the ability to evoke emotion, to capture a moment that can make people think or reevaluate without necessarily telling people what to think. I just think that whatever our psyche makeup is, that we respond well to story.
It's actually pretty well documented now, and there's even a stream in medicine, as you're aware of, narrative medicine, where you don't, as a physician, interrupt people, you let them tell their story, because you learn so much more. And in Indigenous culture, that's always been the way to teach. You don't say, do this, this is page 4 in the manual. You say, let me tell you a story about Bear. And Bear was unhappy one day, and then the moral lesson is taught. It's interesting, there is a number of famous storytellers who are part of Dawson City's history. Pierre Burton lived in Dawson City for a while. Jack London, you know, Call of the Wild. Robert Service, the cremation of Sam McGee, were all involved with Dawson City's history. We're getting close to the end of the show, but I just wonder if you could talk about how telling stories can be a way of, for us as a species, to start relearning the lessons we need to adopt to have a sustainable ecosystem and to live at peace with that ecosystem in what you call symbiosis, which I think is a exactly precise term.
Yeah, I feel story has a really important role in exactly what you just mentioned. And again, I guess it's because it's engaging, it can include humor, it can include emotion, it is often relatable in a way that arguments and facts aren't. It can be hopeful, it doesn't have to be doomsday. It has a way of showing, being able to show an alternate way of being or thinking or doing is really powerful.
Yeah, it puts us in the shoes of the protagonist in the story. We cannot stop ourselves from identifying, if that was us, would we have done what that person did? And the difference between what they do and what we've done is where we start to pause and think. Do you have any... Just as before we end, do you have any new projects? Are you working on a... They always ask this of filmmakers, what's your next film going to be about? And you don't have to answer that question, but I'm asking it anyway.
Yes, it's the kind of question that often I don't like being asked, because a film sometimes takes 4 or 5 years. And when you're first finished a film, you're in recovery mode. And so there isn't a lot of brain power to be thinking about the next film. You're just sort of recovering from the last one. But I always have another idea in my head. And I am, in fact, working on another project. This time it's an hybrid animation project. So I'm moving more into working with animators and trying that way of storytelling. This new project is about listening to our elders and what we can learn from them. So it is a project listening to a 97-year-old woman tell stories about her life growing up in Dawson after the gold rush in the early 1900s.
You know, you've just summarized the whole history of human interaction, the ages, the elderly, the young, learning from all, interacting with all. What a wonderful time we've had today. Suzanne Crocker, it's been a delight talking with you on the radio. And someday we'll probably have you back when your new project comes forward. Thank you so much for sharing your tale of serendipity and purpose and creativity. It's been a wonderful time together. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.